Geico presents sharing versus oversharing. Earlier this week, Claire Tippins shared a princess nickname generator, 3 pictures of her dog wearing a tutu, and 2 online quizzes, including, what candy is your dream castle made of? Claire, your sharing has tipped the sugar scale and turned into oversharing. But have no fear, princess. Geico has something worth sharing with your internet kingdom, like how you could save hundreds on your car insurance just by visiting geico.com. No magic wand required. Geico, 15 minutes could save you 15% or more on car insurance.
Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Relationships Matter with Dr. Annie Abram. We will help you to understand your interactions with others so that you can create meaningful communications with the closest people in your life, as well as someone you meet fleetingly, such as a stranger on a bus. Join Dr. Annie Abram and expert guests for a deeper understanding of your relationships, how to make them better, and most importantly, how to make them matter. Please be advised that this show is not a substitute for psychotherapy. Tune in every Monday at 12:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Here is your host, Dr. Annie Abram.
Hello, everyone, and thank you so much for tuning in today. Today we have as our guest Maya Upak, who has been involved in sex trafficking for 10 years. She's held a number of positions, and she is working for the Justice Department currently in getting several projects going. She's also the principal consultant and founding partner at CreateN, a consulting company that drives innovative ideas into action using business, communication, and design. Thank you so much for joining me, Maya. Hello.
Hi. Thanks for inviting me.
Of course. I know that you've been in the sex trafficking business for 10 years. Can you give us a timeline in terms of what's happened over the past 10 years in sex trafficking?
Sure. So I can really only give you my perspective, and I know that that would probably be different for a lot of others in the field of anti-trafficking, but I remember when I graduated from university in 2009, and I really wanted to dedicate my career to this issue, largely because I knew someone very close to me that had been trafficked as a child, and that's why it became a very personal cause for me. But I graduated during the height of the recession, and I was trying to get into this field and see what impact I could make. So as you can imagine, it was just difficult anyway to find any particular job or specific job to fight human trafficking, but people didn't really know that human trafficking existed still in that day and age. I mean, I didn't even know that it existed until a few years before that when my friend disclosed to me that she had been trafficked as a child. Because, you know, you hear about human trafficking or rather slavery growing up, and many of us think, well, that's not still going on, but in fact, it is happening in every industry. And it can happen to everyone or to anyone. But again, in 2009, folks didn't really know what it was or that it was still going on. There were some agencies that were starting to address it, such as Polaris, which is a national organization that runs the National Human Trafficking Resource Center hotline and other various programs. And I was fortunate to be a fellow of and work directly with clients in 2010. But there was also the district attorney's office in Alameda County, which is in Oakland, California, near San Francisco. And that's the agency that I ended up connecting with because the district attorney there, Nancy E. O'Malley, who's the elected DA, she had started to notice in the 90s that a lot of these young girls were coming into the courtroom on prostitution-related charges. And she thought it was really odd because these were young girls who, you know, legally couldn't even consent to having sex, and yet they were being brought in for prostitution-related charges and wanted to do a little bit more investigating into that and noticed there were various risk factors amongst this population or various themes and then developed a prosecution unit specifically around human trafficking or child sex trafficking. And so I came on board in 2010 to run that program and build it from a prosecution unit into what it is today, which is a statewide initiative. But over time, folks started conducting research. So there's Dr. Estes out of UPenn, who back a couple years ago published research on the sexual exploitation of homeless youth. Again, folks didn't really know that, you know, that's one form of human trafficking in America, and started publishing data on this population. And then, like I mentioned, other agencies started coming on board. The Department of Justice took notice. The State Department took notice, so that they were also now tackling and addressing, addressing human trafficking outside of the U.S. and also in the U.S. And little by little, the conversation started to be had that not only, again, is human trafficking still going on, but it happens, again, in every industry and can happen to anyone. And since then, there is a national human trafficking hotline number. And for folks who don't know what that number is, it's 1-888-373-7888. And you can call for information or also to report suspected human trafficking.
Could you just repeat that again? 1-888-373-7888.
Correct.
And,
yep,
okay.
That's perfect.
Okay,
and
so that's sex trafficking hotline.
Well, that's the human trafficking hotline. So, again, you can report all types of trafficking.
Can you make a distinction between human trafficking and sex trafficking?
I would make the distinction between labor trafficking and sex trafficking.
Okay.
And, again, my specialty and my expertise is primarily on child sex trafficking in America. So, you know, if it's not very comprehensive, that would be the reason why. But essentially, while there are elements of sexual assault in labor trafficking, where there can be elements of sexual assault in labor trafficking, primarily labor trafficking might look like not being able to leave your at will your work, being forced to work more hours, basically having been lied to about your working conditions. So you might have been promised, you know, a restaurant job, and then instead you have to, you are working the restaurant job, but you can't really leave without, you know, permission from, let's say, your trafficker. You might have your passports taken away. You might have, if there are elements of immigration there, you might not be able to leave the premises. You might be living on the premises and not have your, essentially your basic working rights respected. And then there's sex trafficking where, again, there could also be elements of labor trafficking, but the primary focus is that, at least in America, sex trafficking can look like prostitution. However, you don't have the ability to also leave your trafficker, who can also look like a pimp. And your pimp collects all the money, same in labor trafficking. The trafficker might have a debt over your head and you're working to pay it off, but because of, you know, exorbitant amount of, you know, fees or whatnot and interest, there's no way for you to actually pay that off. And the
so
same
it's
can
really
be seen in
slavery in a different context, right?
Right.
Human trafficking
right.
and sex trafficking. But it amounts to the same thing in terms of one's being enslaved.
Correct. Yes, absolutely.
Right. And so go ahead with your timeline. So if you could bring us up to date, you know, in terms of where we are.
Sure. I mean, so as more and more agencies started getting on board with the issue of human trafficking and, let's say, child sex trafficking, there were more initiatives that were rolled out across the nation, locally, statewide, and nationally. There was the creation of the National Human Trafficking Awareness Month. I know it has a different name right now, but essentially it's a recognition in January that human trafficking still exists and that we need to work to prevent it. And And there's been a lot more agencies that have a focus or at least some sort of arm around the issue of human trafficking. So let's say there's a rape crisis center. Maybe they also might have a program within their rape crisis center to address individuals that come to them who are also being trafficked and under the control of a pimp, for example, when we're talking about child sex trafficking. So the exposure right now and the conversation that's being had is quite public, more than it was before, even a couple years ago. There's still a long ways to go, though. Some of the issues that we see right now is we don't really still have good data on this population, largely because it's such an illicit crime that no one's really talking about it, and it's really hard to identify, which is why we have these public awareness campaigns across the nation.
Mm-hmm.
But even still, if we're talking about not understanding really the dynamics of this crime outside of what we've heard from survivors directly, which is helpful, which is anecdotal but also qualitative. But quantitatively, that type of data can teach us and show us how we need to respond and move forward. So we actually, when I was working for the Alameda County District Attorney's Office as their program coordinator for the Human Exploitation and Trafficking or Heat Watch program, we developed a program called Safety Net, which is a multidisciplinary weekly case review. And we would, by the time I left, we had about 17 multidisciplinary agencies at the table every week, from probation to social services to service providers to the DA and the public defender's office. So very dynamic. And we were talking, and we had about a caseload of over 450 clients. And now I think it's even over 560 clients. We wouldn't talk about them every week, of course, but more the priority cases. But that ability to take a look at 400 cases in Alameda County in the Oakland, California area allowed us to get some local data on this population that then taught us and showed us what we're working with, what type of child sex trafficking we're working with, who our demographics were of the population we were serving, and what needs that they actually needed. And that's why, of course, data is important. Unfortunately,
right.
We don't
What were those what were those demographics?
Sure. So in Alameda County, we largely had girls, so about 99% were girls, although that could be partly because of the way that the clients were referred to us. Also, law enforcement is not necessarily looking for boys. Boy trafficking looks different than girl trafficking and operates differently. So I'm definitely very passionate about making sure we include not just girls, but boys and transsexual youth who are being trafficked. But the population also was largely African-American, Latina, and Caucasian girls. The majority had runaway history and child sexual abuse history, which was telling, because if we know, for example, that a lot of them started off being sexually abused or had some form of child abuse when they were, 5 to 8 years old, and then by the time they're 13, they're being recruited to basically go in the game, to work in the game, to be trafficked, there is an opportunity there for us to potentially provide services and intercept and address something that could be coming up the pipeline and ultimately prevent that from happening in the first place. So over time, when we started to see this data coming through, we began to develop certain protocols and policies in our county to make sure that we can start addressing those at-risk youth, but also being able to address the immediate needs of those already involved in child sex trafficking.
Mm-hmm. And so how would you find those people, educate them? What exactly would the process be?
Do you mean educate the community, or are you meaning educate the clients?
Educate the clients.
Well, that can happen many different ways. When many of these girls came to us through the delinquency system or the dependency system, so foster care or probation. And the way that, at least in Alameda County, we structured our approach to fighting child sex trafficking was very multidisciplinary. We relied a lot on our various partners. So it wasn't just the district attorney who was the lead. It was also our partners who were service providers, like Bay Area Women Against Rape, or social services, or probation, or really any agency that was willing to show up to the table. And once a girl was identified, they would be referred to our safety net program. They might also be referred to other types of programs specific to their needs in our county. And we really were attempting to wrap our arms around them and through that process, educate them. There also is one program called the Young Women Saturday Program that we developed. And that essentially is a 12-week program for child sex trafficking youth or at-risk youth. And they go through this course where they learn skills that maybe they didn't learn growing up. So how do you write a resume? How do you dress appropriately for a job? How do you have healthy relationships? And so through that educational program, they were able to learn potentially, you know, what's actually going on, because a lot of these victims don't identify as traditional victims and will think of their trafficker as their boyfriend because they love them. But, of course, that's a form of trauma bonding and
right.
Stockholm syndrome. But essentially that's one way that we could – you know, incorporate a form of education to help them see to help them address the issue that they're facing or the challenges that they're facing. But also, and I know this is might be relevant to your listeners, addressing their mental health, right? So they did work with various mental health organizations such as West Coast Children's Clinic, and they have a specific child sex trafficking program and trained therapists, which is key. You need to have trained individuals to work with this population, and through that process, helping them realize the dynamics of the trafficker, their relationship with their trafficker, and to see it what it really was helpful.
Right. I'm wondering now if there is any attempt at early intervention. So, for example, a child might be sexually abused. And we know that the likelihood of that resulting in sex trafficking for that child is certainly much higher than in the general population. If that child is identified by the mental health system, by the foster care system, is there any way of doing early intervention, or have there been any programs?
So that was essentially what we were starting to do right before I left. We had the child advocacy centers there who conduct forensic interviews with victims of, you know, child abuse, child sexual assault, child sex trafficking. We had, of course, social services and other service providers. So when we started addressing or noticing that a lot of the population that was coming in through safety net were also victims of child sexual abuse when they were even younger, of course, one approach that we began to have was, if there's a young child that's, you know, comes in through the Child Advocacy Center, so the CAC, that then they would potentially refer them to Safety Net and from there get connected to mental health services and the various supports that they needed. Because at the end of the day, it's really a case-by-case basis, which makes it even that much harder to combat, because there are a lot of girls and boys and transsexual youth that need these services, but they need them in their own unique way because it looks different, even though there's a general theme. So that's something to,
right.
to
well, I
think
mean,
about.
I think that, you know, without question, for most of these young people, they need trauma treatment.
Absolutely.
And, you know, that is very difficult to offer to a kid who's living at home. Right.
Right. And you're addressing, again, a really key point because, you know, many of the girls are that came to Safety Net were system involved or are system involved. And so that just means foster care, probation. So they might go and get referred to a group home or even an out-of-state group home in our county. And they could have a great program and have great therapy and great, you know, all around overall care. But if they come back to the same environment that exploited them in the first place, how do you then sustain the strides that they made? And that's been a big conversation. Right. And well, that's been a really big conversation. So it's not just even a mental health approach or services approach. Then you need to expand and go out to the community and start educating the community, which is also one of the things that I did for the district attorney's office, and I continue to do for them as a consultant now. So going out and having the community through billboard campaigns, graphic novels, series, podcasts, training, which is all what we conducted at the district attorney's office or through the district attorney's office, we really were trying to not only address this issue, but also address the myths and misconceptions, the risk factors, the red flags, and then challenging the perception that these are not prostitutes. These are victims of child sex trafficking. These are also victims of rape. I mean, to be really very blunt, I mean, these are a lot of the girls that were being trafficked and boys, they're underage. And they're not consenting. And the age of consent in California is 18. But, you know, we saw girls as young as 13. It's not younger.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we really need to also challenge the thought that these are not these are not pimps, they're traffickers. Because sometimes when people think of a pimp, they think, oh, he's cool. I look up to him. But no, not in this context, absolutely not. And then lastly, we attempted to change the thought process around John. So my former boss, D.A. O'Malley, would say, my husband's name is John, and he's a very nice guy, and I don't feel comfortable using the word John to describe buyers and essentially rapists, child rapists. So that's another discussion that's going on across the nation where they're not just talking about victim identification, they're also talking about going after the trafficker and holding them accountable, and then also going after the buyers and holding them accountable. But we as a community have a role to play as well.
Right. You bring up an interesting point, and that is the difference between what has become to be known as the abolitionist, right, and those who are for decriminalization of prostitution. And can you give us a basic understanding of each side? I know there's some very prominent feminists who are abolitionists, and I also know there are some who are very much in favor of decriminalizing prostitution. So could you briefly lay out that argument for us?
Well, I think the way that I want to approach answering this question is that I'm in the business of fighting child sex trafficking in particular. And the choices that someone wants to make with regards to prostitution or rather sex work is up to that individual if they're old enough to consent and they're making their choices for themselves and there's no coercion or force or fraud going on, which are all elements of human trafficking.
Mm-hmm.
But again, so I'm not really going to make a comment on that because I want to that's not really my area of expertise. But with regards to the conversation around child sex trafficking in America or sex trafficking in America, there are oftentimes two sides of the same coin in a way, where there are folks that will say, that have argued, well, there's really no other way to get a victim away from their trafficker currently in the system that we have in place without mm-hmm. arresting them, because that is an opportunity to, again, remove them from the situation and connect them to services. And there are some who argue for that. And then there are others who might argue, well, how can you even arrest in the first place if they're a minor, they haven't even consented, and they're a victim? And I can also see the argument for that too, because that's also right. But I think the challenge is, and the bigger challenge is that it's more of a systemic issue, but we don't have across the nation a consistent approach to how do we actually, you know, once we interface with a victim and they're identified, what do we actually do with them to make sure that they can get away from the trafficker and from their situation, and we can empower them to start healing or go on that healing process, but also empower them in general, right? We want to have more of a victim-centered approach rather than a criminal-centered approach, or a criminalization approach. And as you can see, it is a bit, it's very complex, and there is no real easy answer because there are laws in this nation that, you know, if you are picked up for prostitution, you have to, you're either cited and released or you have to be brought into custody, just depending on various factors and just what it, what the laws are in each jurisdiction. But even still, we need to be cognizant of, you know, once, let's say we bring in a girl or a boy, but we bring in, you know, a victim into custody, we need to have this, a system in place where they are treated as victims and not as criminals, that maybe once they're identified as a victim of trafficking, there are ways for their for what they were what they came in on to be reduced. So, you know, they might come in on prostitution-related charges, but once they're identified as victims, you know, that could be minimized or wiped clean. So some states do have that. And in fact, Polaris has creates a state-by-state report card, and so does Shared Hope International, which is another anti-trafficking organization. But they have a essentially a rating system on the type of laws that each state has around human trafficking. Sure, the type of laws that each state has around human trafficking to essentially address, you know, when someone's identified, depending on the type of trafficking and how they came into the system, what do we do from there? Do we, you know, decriminalize? Do we remove their any charges on the record or clear the record? I mean, there's so many approaches that we could take, and then also making sure that, of course, the victim is connected to services and their traffickers and offenders are held accountable. I mean, that's it's really sort of a holistic approach that needs to be had, and that's that much more, you know, difficult because earlier I was saying, well, we need a case-by-case basis or approach to working with these clients, and yet we also need to look at the system in place to see how, in fact, it's supporting the fight against human trafficking, too.
Well, it seems to me that there are any number of ways of dealing with this situation, and obviously law enforcement needs to be involved on many different levels. And abolitionists, of course, feel that it should not be decriminalized, and those who are not abolitionists feel that it should be, right?
Well, I don't want to even say it's that black and white either, because
is that what?
I wouldn't even say that it's that black and white either, right? That
okay.
Abolitionists
so,
think one
yeah,
or the
that's
other.
That's what I'm interested in, the part that's not black and white, the part that we can join, you know, together. How can we do that, and what would it look like? Because it seems to me now that there is quite a black and white perspective. And I'm wondering if there's any way, or has there been, an effort to let both sides know that the reality is, from my perspective at least, that they have more in common than not.
Right. So I think that at the end of the day, I think what will, what unifies us is that, and I've heard this even on both sides, that you know, when it comes to a minor or when it comes to an individual who's being forced to sell their body for sex, that's what essentially is what unifies us and what we want to prevent. So there needs to be ways, laws, services, approaches, policies and protocols that essentially, and just approaches, overall approaches, that tackle that. Because what made, for example, what made Safety Network in Alameda County with all this, these diverse agencies that had completely different perspectives on this very issue was that we came together to talk about the minor and what needs that they needed in that very moment. We didn't talk about the broader case or the legalities or even, I mean, sometimes, of course, we had general conversations around this, but when it came to the case itself and what we needed to do for the client, we only talked about their well-being and what we needed to do to address their well-being. And I think that that is something that we, that both sides have come together on. Because again, you know, anyone who's being taken advantage of or being exploited, that's something that we can come together around and needs to happen. And I think even on both sides of the store of this argument, from those who are pro-sex worker to those who are anti-human trafficking, I don't really see the conflict there when we're talking specifically about the fact that, like, we don't want anyone to be exploited against their will.
Right. However, there seems to be a very entrenched political system that makes it very difficult for these two groups to find, you know, mutual space.
Yeah. Yeah. And unfortunately, I don't have a magic answer for that.
Right. Except, I don't think anyone does. Right.
Right. Except to say, again, let's just keep focusing on, when we're talking about this issue, if we want to come to a unifying theme, it would be, how do we make sure that individuals are not being sexually exploited against their will?
Right, right. Maya, thank you so much. Our time is up, but I so appreciate your depth of knowledge and experience, and thank you for sharing with us. I'm wondering if you could offer a place where people might learn more about you, a website.
Sure. Okay. Yeah, so I recently launched my consulting company. As you mentioned, it's called Create and my focus is helping individuals and organizations move from ideas to action, particularly around social issues like human trafficking, but really just generally speaking, complex issues. And they can reach out to me at Maya, M-A-I-A, at createand.co, C-O. They could also find me on LinkedIn at Maya, M-A-I-A, C-U-P-A-C, C-I-U-P-A-C. And I'm on Twitter as well, under WhoDatMaya. So I have a little bit of New Orleans love in me. So who?
So, what was that Twitter?
Yeah, it's a W.
What was it?
Yeah, I'm spelling it out. It's WhoDatMaya. So that's just a little love for New Orleans right there.
Okay.
Please feel free to reach out to me. I'm sorry, what?
That gives us something of your personality.
Yes,
your love for
exactly.
New Orleans.
Yes. I love New Orleans.
Yeah.
Yep.
Maya, again, thank you so much. I appreciate your coming on to the show, and I know that we'll get a lot of listeners and a lot of questions. So thanks again.
Wonderful. And please feel free to reach out to me. And I'm happy to continue the conversation. So thank you very much for your invitation.
That's
again.
Wonderful. Great. Thanks. You are listening to Relationships Matter with Dr. Annie Abram, a show about social justice, mindful relationships, and parenting. We air every Monday at 12:30 p.m. Eastern Time. You can call us at 646-716-5232 during show time. Or you can email me at Dr. Ann, no E, Abram, A-B-R-A-M, at gmail.com, or follow on Twitter at Ask, A-S-K, Dr. D-R, Annie, A-N-N-I-E. Thanks again for listening, and talk with you next week.
Are you thinking about buying medicine online? A search for online pharmacies yields more than 20 million results. But which ones can you trust? Medicines bought from unlicensed online pharmacies can be dangerous. You may get a fake drug, your condition may get worse, or you may experience a bad reaction. Don't put your health at risk. To learn how to find an online pharmacy that's safe and legal, visit fda.gov/besaferx. A message from the U.S. Food and Drug Administration.